Welcome to the XJ Music Podcast, where we explore new possibilities in background music for video games, live streaming, and environments. I'm founder Charney K, here with co-founder Jamal Whitaker.
Hey, hey!
Everyone's talking about AI these days. On one side, AI evangelists rejoice in their newfound ability to create art without having any actual artistic ability or committing the years of discipline required to master a craft. On the other side, true artists lament the widespread plagiarization and commodification of their life's passion. We're joined today by Axel Shemla Romeo Santos, who is both an artist and a technologist, a published computer scientist, and a graduate of the prestigious Urquhart Institute in Paris, a researcher exploring sound jointly through music, sound design, and science. He's the real deal, pushing the boundary of music-generating neural networks and music itself. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks. So yeah, I'm Axel Shemla Romeo Santos with a French accent. I graduated both in music and engineering science, and this is how I entered the Urquhart, and actually, initially, I just wanted to create weird sounds. It was really at the very beginning of neural networks before it was cool, as a hipster would say. And so we started experimenting with all this very, very basic stuff at the time. I started in 2014. Mm. And so I started, of course, with musical ambitions. I was making musical aside from my PhD work. Mm. One of the first real-time performances at the time with spectral variation autoencoders.
Cool.
With my friend Hugo Scurto at the time, where he was himself working on a reinforcement agent that was made actually to explore parameters from synthesizers. Mm. Let's say that this kind of machine learning generators have parameters. So we made this first performance with his agent that he was controlling with his hands, generating music actually just with that. And then I graduated actually just 1 week before COVID.
Oh, wow.
Same here.
Good luck, right? Yeah. And so it was rather a quiet year.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, in terms of research, quite quiet, of course, because research, it's not said enough, but it's really always a collective adventure. I mean, So I made, yes, a lot of compositions involving all my work. I also like developed framework to actually manage to reach somehow extrapolation with machine learning, meaning that, for example, how we can use these machines to generate novel sounds instead of just reproducing it somehow. There is something very important also to have in mind, is that what we call now artificial intelligence is a subfield of artificial intelligence that we call machine learning.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, artificial intelligence exists for a very, very long time. I mean, well, the inventor of the word is Norman Wiener. That was, yeah, in the 50s, 60s. Mm. He's a brilliant guy. It's very interesting to read his writings, actually, because he was like a technician, but also a philosopher. And actually, all the problems we deal with now, he has forecasted in some ways.
Oh, interesting.
His book is called God and Golem, you know?
Yeah.
Golem, like the touch of God that turns mud into salt.
Mm.
And so it's really, really fascinating, actually, to see that all the things we're facing now was really like conceived since the beginning by its own very creator.
Wow.
Sure.
Yeah.
Wow.
But at the time, actually, I was asking myself the question, what are the new problems we are facing more than, I mean, just automatization? That is actually a philosophical and a social problem since the Industrial Revolution. So it's really not new.
Yeah.
Mm. And actually, what is really new now is that actually this subfield of artificial intelligence that is called machine learning is actually like inverting the way of doing techniques and also science now. Because first it was like human mind just shaping architectures of knowledge.
Mm.
And now we totally inverted the process, is that actually we have like dumped machines with a lot of data. And then we expect these machines to find the solutions by their own, involving, of course, existing data. For generation, it's a very, very big topic. Because, for example, if you took generative systems before machine learning, it was like, you know, constrained random systems that was making, like, for example, in games like Rogue, you know, roguelike, of course.
Mm-hmm.
It has been implemented in video games since its beginning, actually. It was really like, yeah, conceiving generators that used randomness, actually, to create architectures and this kind of stuff. And now, actually, it's not really the same, because you have to have existing data that will, and the machine will learn actually how to reproduce it, but also in a way that won't actually really escape what he's been trained on.
Mm.
It uses randomness, but in another way. For example, one of the main generative system is called L system, for example. You know, it's how we make trees, for example, in video games.
Mm.
Okay, you have a line. At the random point at the line, you can have two splits and one again, you know, and with this very, very simple formula, you can actually make things that are not trees at all, you know.
Mm.
With machine learning, it's not really the same process, because actually you learn the machine to reproduce. in Counter-Strike, yes, for example, bots from Counter-Strike 1 are not like the bots that are playing StarCraft by learning a million of plays. You know, it's really not the same thing.
Right.
And this is really different. Grounding the algorithm on existing data. Actually, it's kind of schizophrenic because you want it to make something new, but you evaluate it and you train it so it doesn't.
Right.
So it's really like paradoxical in some way.
Interesting. We've been looking over Rave, the real-time audio variational autoencoder for training a neural network on audio and then generating audio from that. And we were curious about, for example, your latest set at ACIDS, Genesis. You said it's the first attempt of using audio generative neural networks without the resort to any human data, amplifying the own materiality of the algorithms towards cybernetic chaos rather than nature imitation. So tell us about that.
Yeah, the idea of no data training. Actually, I have to say hello to Terence Broad. That is one of the first guy that actually did that. He really used like two generators, actually just comparing themselves against each other. And actually, like, rather than learning by being fed some data, they're just being trained actually just to like make different things from the other. And he actually, yes, made a series of images with that. And yeah, my idea was like to extend this idea.
Sure.
Rather than actually taking neural networks and making them train on the similarity of existing data, I really take like single agents, and instead of making them train on to reproduce data, I just say to them, just give me the most possible different things you can. So it has an input, because of course every neural network has an input as an output. It trains it this way. You cannot really like overcome that. But what you can do, of course, is just making a loss function. I mean, this is a function that you use to train the algorithm that does not rely on any data. And so actually I just like take random inputs and just with some criteria actually like say to them, make me whatever you want. I just want you to make the most different possible things. Everything that you try to hide when you design neural networks for reproduction, actually, this is what you use for no input trainings, because actually you just overemphasize all the artifacts and bugs of the thing instead of trying to hide them. And this is how, of course, the output is not really pop music, that's for sure.
Sure.
But what is very interesting is that you really have a direct contact with the materiality, you know, really like in experimental music.
What you're doing is kind of the opposite of what it looks like some of your earlier work was in regularization of those latent spaces. So you're kind of doing the opposite of that.
I use like modular synthesis or additive synthesis, like, but I really enter like in the technical and experimental capabilities of what it can make. It was also, of course, inspired by industrial music because it's really like, let's just forget about what we expect as humans. Little also like in system theory in art, you know, in the 60s, and just do your own work. Actually, I also developed a library to be able to hijack actually all the inner parameters of the machine in real time. So actually it generates stuff, and then as a performer, I mean, I'm really lost in the huge variety of control. It's not really a control, actually, it's really a co-improvisation. But when I entered this domain, I have still actually a very simple mind. I was like very used to synthesizers and this kind of stuff. Okay, synthesizers, it has many buttons. I mean, the neural networks have the capacity to shape everything possible. It has like 1 billion buttons. And that it was kind of dumb. I mean, genuine, let's say. It was very genuine. It was not actually that wrong, but this is what I do for 2 years. So I really like, you know, a gap of almost 10 years in some kind of unbalanced thing.
That's great.
You know, you always do what you want the most at the very end of the day when you're tired. But it's really like a full toolbox to take any possible existing AI thing that is open source and actually perform a network bending on it. So being able actually to, like, you know, really like where you, with like circuit bending, when you just, you know, change the wires, make some experiments to change the sound. And I make a library to be able to make this on music gen of Facebook, for example, diffusers, and to actually be able to perform something new that is much more interesting, actually.
Very cool. That's a cool new term for me, network bending.
This is also Terence Broad. It was actually very, very interesting. He was very pioneer at the time. It was like in 2018.
Okay.
It's always somehow I say things that seems very old, but it's just 6 years.
No, that's
moving fast.
I know. I mean, I've been at this all for a long time.
When I was making my PhD, it was really like GPT-3. This was really like the thing that made me understood the new wave of artificial intelligence, because like, you know, GPT-2 was like a research product. And really, GPT-3 was really emblematic of that, because the paper was just that we just multiplied the number of parameters, the capacity of the model by 1 billion. Don't remember, it was like
huge very model. Yeah.
Huge model. We multiplied the data by, but it was at the time, it was really like, if you're just not seeing the data you're training your models on, you were just, you know, fired, you're not published. They hid the data, they just multiplied everything by 1 million, and they said, it works better.
Yeah.
But indeed, it worked better, because it's not always the case.
Yeah.
It just worked more.
Yeah.
So that's fascinating to me. When we heard no input, we thought, well, you know, no human input to the performance. But it actually sounds like it's sort of the other interpretation. You mean that there's no input training data, but then you, as the person in the space, you actually are deeply involved in the performance.
Yeah, there. With my supervisor, that is, of course, one of my best friends, Philippe Esselin. Hello, Philippe. Also working with my friend Hugo, and also with musicians, because I was a musician myself. And also, of course, with IRCAM, because IRCAM is a place where actually composers compose.
Yeah.
You know, computer scientists are really like always targeting the way of automatizing, of course.
Sure.
You have to deal with musicians. And of course, honestly, musicians, they really don't care if you have a machine that reproduces a violin, because they play violin.
Right.
You know, for example, for video games, that what do you expect this machine for? Actually, like everything that has to do with reproduction, it's made to deal with something that we call, for example, in human-computer interaction, empowerment. It's meaning that it's made for people that don't have the skills to make such things. Really, as a musical matter, you cannot do that, because, like, honestly, it's not interesting at all. And so I really had to think, what is the real interest in this perspective of such machines? And actually, it's, of course, the deconstruction of reality. And at the very end, I mean, Genesis to me is it's a spectrum, you know, like the full dependency on the data and no data at all, and all the possible things between, an experiment to be very radical on this aspect.
Interesting. The work that we've been getting into has to do with, when we look at video game composition, we're sort of working with composers who already have strong musical backgrounds, traditional ideas about the way that they want to build the mood of a video game. And perhaps within that, we're trying to offer more randomization, you know, more different varieties. People composing for that space want a lot of control, I think.
Of course. Yeah. I mean, technology is made for that.
Right.
There is always this kind of schizophrenia between the need of control and the need of randomness.
Yeah.
If you release a generative model that can be commercialized and this kind of stuff, you have to prove, for example, that your model does not learn by heart existing data, and actually kind of manages to mix things at a point that it's not under some constraints, not the thing, but I mean, for example, it makes pop music. So actually it really makes some kind of a mashup of mixdown of every pop music possible. And what is pop music in 2023? But it would not be, you know, a specific music.
Right.
For example, it must be under like 0.8% of the model outputs that is this close to an existing song. But this is not new, and this is what also interests me. And this is not another problem, because actually there are always this kind of tendency between control and randomness. Randomness being, for example, the behavior of the player, for example, but also like the behavior of the agents in the video games. And it's always like a trade-off between both.
Talking about control, if we delve into the realm of control and music, we were listening to your group and the fact that you had taken one of your albums and used Rave to take your whole discography and do essentially what you were talking about, a mix down of Dom's entire discography into one album and then generate it again. Tell us a little bit about the group and that method right there, because it really produced some incredible results.
Yeah, it's really weird.
Yeah.
One of the members of Dom is a friend I made the performance of with AI with, and the third guy is one of my best friends for a very, very long time. And it's a really strange story as a band, because actually, yes, we are kind of artificial intelligence ourselves. For example, at the very beginning, we really tried to copy popular music, and we just discovered very quickly that we couldn't. And so, yeah, it was like a struggle to find ourselves. Personally, actually, what unleashed really, I mean, what we found ourselves good at, actually, like attacking our unconsciousness that was always based on internet, numerism, of course, artificial intelligence, because we were working on that. Mm-hmm. And of course, I was working with Rave, with Antoine at the time, that is the creator of Rave. Yeah, actually, it's a phenomenon called cycle consistency in the technical domain, is that, for example, if you enter an image into an AI, it is a way to evaluate the model to like feed, you know, the output into the input a numerical amount of time. Because if there are some errors actually in the reconstruction, it's a good thing to see if the model will amplify them. And we're making some experiments into that, and we actually found that really fascinating, because the process actually of normalization, you know, you take something and normalize it, then you apply this process ever again.
Yeah.
And this is how actually we discovered, and like AI was somehow doing that also, you know, used in this way. It is very like paradoxical, because it has this kind of level of progressism, and this is really like the technical progress. But when you think about it, actually, it may also be understood as the most reactionist technology ever, because it will always reproduce actually what it has been trained on. And to us, it was also like an artistic take to show this phenomenon, but in music and not with any big discourse, and less, just to make it feel, I mean, as a musical experience. 24 songs for 24 hours of a yeah, working man, that really all this day is just advertisement music with very precise timings. I mean, the final track is so fucking depressing. And really, like, no, it's always making the same stuff, that is some kind of this mushy, almost vaporware-ish, but for nowhere.
Right, right. Hey,
and it's like very fascinating.
Yeah, it's definitely fascinating. I make, you know, my own production myself. I go by the name of Voodoo Lion. I mostly do like hip hop, you know, beats. And I found myself thinking, like, what if I were to do essentially the same thing, take my entire discography, and like, how would I do that? Would I try to parse it down, and, you know, all my beats down into stems? Would it make a difference? It was a really fun thing to imagine while I was listening to this project.
What is kind of funny is that it really depends on the music, but for example,
right,
on our music, we're like making, like changing aesthetics like every 10 seconds. Mm-hmm. And that actually, like, the model was totally unable to learn what we were. What we, were we didn't even have the choice, actually. It was really, really bad. I even trained a thing on our multi-tracks. It was even worse.
Oh, okay. Interesting. Interesting. Because it just had less to go on.
To be honest, it also depends a lot on the technology you are using. Because, for example, Rave is kind of, it's an in-between between like old machine learning of the 2010 and novel machine learning, you know, as you see with Midjourney and blah, blah, blah.
Sure. Yeah.
And there are a lot of ways, for example, to make very precise outputs. And honestly, it was both. We did not want to do that much. And we also didn't arrive because we didn't have at IRCAM the computational capacities to be like really, in terms of scale, it's not even comparable to what is needed now for things like Midjourney or
huge machines,
and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And things that you can use on your little laptop, for example, and in your discography. Your discography, I don't know, but just tell me. Well, I will train a model on yours if you want.
Awesome.
That's totally no problem. And so I also started to organize like a series of events with composers and developers that were interested to get involved in really musical creation. That is definitely a different agenda that we were used to have in scientific posters.
Yeah.
And so now I'm more into the artistic field, trying to find a lot of ways to use that, and also to find conceptual frames, and also to ideas actually more critical about what's going on with the now advent of generative AI that is everywhere, and that it was not at my time.
Way back then.
Exactly. It was to enforce also my scientific fellows that were interested in music, but that constrained themselves to make just science. No, use your stuff. Otherwise, you cannot work with a composer, and you cannot be proud of what you do if you don't use it. And so use it also with an audience, with a full process. These concerts are free also, because if there is a price, you know, we there to also to think, I am a musician, I cannot make bad music, you know. I mean, when you're a musician, I think you know it yourselves, you know. It's really like it's a big process of feeling confident and feeling confident with what you do.
Right.
And so I work also with Cirque Electrique in Paris, that are friends of mine that are really like cool and welcoming events like this. And it's a circus, so it's amazing.
That's awesome. It does look really cool. I'd love to check that out.
One of the few things that really fear me with artificial intelligence is more like the communication that is made around it. Actually, when you are on Twitter, when you see newspaper, when you see what's online, I mean, that's really the worst information you will ever have. And it really worries me, because if it's the case for AI, I really wonder who I can trust for everything that is also important nearby, you know?
Right, right. When you actually know the territory, that's when you realize how bad the information is.
Yeah, that's really frightening. And we are, for example, some experiences with a journalist that was like the thing of, will the machine replace the human? Was really not our things.
Right.
We had, for example, a documentary with journalists, and we told them like 100 times that it was not the thing.
Right.
We didn't want to show that. And when we saw, of course, the documentary, it was like, it was, at the end, where it was just a blind test of, is it machine or human?
Yeah.
Wow. And it was like, no, but I mean, it's a betrayal. But I mean, I think this is unfortunately common in journalism.
Right.
Just saying the AI.
Right.
You just saying the AI. Like it was like some kind of, a meta object, that was surrounding us, that was, that existed, and that is unique. And it's not the game. It's laboratories that are making products that are different AIs that doesn't have the same behavior, that doesn't have blah, blah, blah. And making a common, common discourse around artificial intelligence, it's nonsense.
Yeah, it's just such an infantile level.
Exactly. And even, and the say of making that something from above, the AI, it's since the beginning actually removes the power of the people to understand it and to fight and have an opinion and blah, blah, blah. Instead of just a reaction of fear, of course, there are these kind of, really religious, there's a priest of AI that will tell you, if you will mount a business without AI, you're screwed. So it's really like, a circle of, of total like alienation somehow, but you make fear people need you, it's like dependency,
People just cannot resist anthropomorphizing these models, and the idea of whether it understands you. And I try to explain to people that I know that don't have any background in this, you type something into ChatGPT and it is just reflecting back to you what you typed in. It isn't, there's no understanding. It does not actually have its own mind or concept or any of those programs in place. And it's interesting what you say to kind of make the religious analogy, that we also, I think, almost default to our most primal instincts to actually look at these things as being godlike or somehow, just totally above us.
But actually, it also works, because scientists cannot explain either.
Yeah.
Because something that is really important to understand is that in the process of producing machine learning stuff, actually you are designing the architecture, you choose the data, and you validate the data with the criteria you give the machine to be evaluated on. And so, of course, there are some, there are ways to circumvent that, the thing between the data you train on, the validation that is not trained, blah, blah, blah. But actually, it's always biased. And of course, I mean, the idea also, of course, of machine learning being biased, it is total nonsense, because the training is biasing your machine.
Yeah, it's made of bias, yes.
So, yeah, and so really, like, for example, my favorite nonsense ever, these kind of things, is that, for example, in audio, if you want to make an article that is, like, kind of solid, you will, like, use a perceptual test, of course, with real humans. But the problem is that you don't have any money to do that. So, and it takes a lot of time, and it's also an expertise by itself. I mean, like making perceptual works for this, it's an amount of work and an amount of knowledge to do that. And so what they did, that they trained a model to forecast the predictions.
Right,
the
people. Of the model.
From the data. And like, you're like, oh, wow. So, so you make the problem, the solution, and the discourse.
Right. It just turtles all the way down.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. In a bubble.
this is techniques. And so nowadays in machine learning, honestly, it's mostly techniques, not science anymore. This is my opinion. I mean, science is more open. It's really like searching. For example, just the fact that you cannot publish a paper on a system that did not work prove that you're not anymore in science.
Yeah.
Okay, it's a proof of concept. I mean, okay, that's more research because you prove that this object can generate this thing. This is science. But for the artistic repercussions of this,
yeah.
No, this is for scientists. This is not for musicians. You know.
Yeah. Not a lot of middle ground. XJ. If you're interested in realizing new possibilities in background music for video games, live streaming, or environments, get at us. Here at XJ, we believe music is human.
Something that artists couldn't even dream of. Now it's at our fingertips. XJ Music.